content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ann Jordan for the North Carolina Reading Service, and welcome to Oprah Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah.com. All right, this first article is called Thanks to the Pandemic, Kenneth Feltz is finally ready to come out at 90 years old. He kept his sexuality hidden for 78 years. Quarantine has been a time of major self-reflection for many people, but few have done so as boldly and bravely as Kenneth Feltz, a 90-year-old Colorado man who recently came out as gay for the first time in his life while writing his memoir. First telling the truth to his daughter, who herself came out to him 25 years ago, the story has quickly spread around the world. In an interview with the Washington Post, Feltz spoke at length about his life and sexuality. He explained that while he lived his life as Ken, a performative straight man, he had an inner, second identity as a gay man named Larry. Part of his motivation for keeping the two selves separate was his conservative Christian upbringing in Kansas. "I learned from the Bible not to be gay. I was planning to take this secret to the grave with me," he said. Feltz lived a full life as a heterosexual man. He married a woman and had a daughter, Rebecca. But Feltz, who said he first realized he was gay at 12 years old, always knew his true self. In the Washington Post piece, Feltz spoke about a man he loved named Philip, whom he met at work in Long Beach, California. Then 29, Feltz had a whirlwind romance with Philip. The two moved in together, but still kept the actual nature of their relationship secret. Feltz said that coming out during the 1960s held a much greater stigma, and he eventually left Philip to try and live as a straight man. "There was no support or community for gay people at that time," Feltz said. "Gay people coming out in the 50s and 60s were on their own. There were no support groups like we have today, and the general public attitude was opposed to gay people." In a video interview with BBC, Feltz said he'd never considered coming out before. But finally, during quarantine, he decided to tell his daughter about Philip, realizing how little of his story he had actually shared with her. "It's the freedom of doing without fear that somebody is going to disparage you for it," he explained. "Before I came out, I was doing everything I could to avoid drawing attention to me. It's a total reversal of my role, and I'm embracing it, and I'm doing what I can for the gay cause." As the LGBT community becomes more widely embraced and supported, many people who have lived in the closet are navigating the terrain of coming out later in life. Hopefully, the brave decision of Kenneth Feltz will inspire others to live their lives openly as their authentic selves, no matter their age. And here we have an article called "Kelly Clarkson Says It's Her Job to Protect Her Kids During Her Divorce." There's a photo that shows Clarkson holding her two young children, and she's giving one a kiss on the nose. In June, Kelly Clarkson filed for divorce from her estranged husband, Brandon Blackstock, following 7 years of marriage. But despite what she admits has been a difficult year, her focus remains on their two kids, daughter River Rose, 6, and son Remington Alexander, 4. "I'm a very open person, but I'm not going to be able to be truly open about this in certain aspects because there's kids involved," she told the LA Times in September regarding her separation. "My children and his older children, there are a lot of little hearts involved in this, and while people feel, 'Oh my gosh, what a loss,' imagine how it is in the epicenter of the storm. It is a lot to process and deal with, just as a family. So because it's not just me, I probably won't go too deep into it." She also said during a September episode of The Kelly Clarkson Show that it was her and her ex's job to protect the kids at this time. Blackstock also had two children from his first marriage, Savannah, age 18, and Seth, aged 13. So when Clarkson married him, she automatically took on the role of second mother to them, admitting that, "I actually really dig the mom thing," during On Air with Ryan Seacrest back in 2013, before she had children of her own. "I've accomplished a lot," the Grammy-winning singer told People in 2015. But I guess the biggest success I want is that whenever I die, people will say, she was so successful as a mother and as a wife. That's kind of my big goal. Not only is that something Clarkson strives for, but she lives her life as a mom now with a newborn confidence. I sound like such a tool, but becoming a mother has made me next level confident. I've never felt more empowered, she told Good Housekeeping in 2016. And there's a photo here, a Christmas photo of the family, and there's a man dressed as Santa Claus, and it says, Merry Christmas from the Blackstocks. All right, this next article is called First-Time Voters Share What's at Stake for Them This Election Season. For some Americans, November 3rd will be historic in many ways. There's a first time for everything, and for these three Americans, November 3rd marks the first time they'll cast a vote for the President of the United States. Here, they open up about what's on the line. Hinda Ahmed, naturalized U.S. citizen. I was born in Somalia in 1988, but I don't remember much about it. When I was three, rebels overthrew the government, and the country essentially collapsed. When I was six, my parents left their successful businesses behind and moved our family to a refugee camp in Uganda. It was supposed to be temporary, but I lived there for 19 years. I'm the youngest of nine, and at the camp we all lived in a two-room house, a glorified tent in the mud. We often didn't have clean water or enough food. To make money, my mom set up a little cafe, selling tea and pancake bread. My brother fixed motorcycles. When I was 25, a refugee agency working with a Catholic charity in the States arranged for me to move to Nashville. That's when I started fresh. I went back to school, got a job as an assistant teacher, built myself up from scratch. This safe, clean city was like nothing I had ever seen before. I loved the easy routines of my new life, the friendly neighbors, the big stores with wide aisles. I have a 4-year-old daughter in pre-K who lives without fear in a house where the fridge is full. That's something I never could have dreamed of when I was young. I was terrified of being deported before becoming a naturalized citizen in November 2019. It's hard to describe how important that moment was. It means I'll be voting this year for the first time, and there has never been a better moment to make my voice heard. Immigrants face policies that seek to make our lives harder. I know Somali refugees who found asylum here but still have family, even children, back in Africa. Because of the immigration ban against some predominantly Muslim countries, they haven't seen one another in years. Those harmful policies turned me into an activist. I started volunteering with a Somali community center, encouraging immigrants to lobby on their own behalf with their local leaders. Maybe 20 years from now, I'll go back to the camp where I grew up and my parents died to help the kids living in poverty there. But for now, I can't wait to fill out my ballot. I'm very optimistic about the future of this country. My home. And here we have a quote from Michelle Obama. The 2016 presidential election was determined by fewer than 80,000 votes spread across three states. But almost 100 million eligible Americans didn't even cast their ballot. I created When We All Vote because your vote is your voice, and you've got to use it. In fact, folks are counting on you not getting registered. They're counting on you forgetting to mail in your ballot or just staying home on election day because they think they can count you out. Don't let them. From fighting a global pandemic to racial injustice and police violence, the urgency around taking action has never been more present. And the easiest, most effective way for you to take action is to get registered, make a plan, and vote. The future of our families, our communities, and our country rest on us showing up and making ourselves heard. Okay, the next voter is Laura Ryder, and she is a student. In middle school, I found an old button in my attic that said, a woman's place is in the house and the Senate. At 12, I didn't quite get the pun, but I knew it had something to do with women's empowerment, and so I was all for it. The next day, I fastened it to the book bag I took to school. When my classmates saw it, they sneered. I wondered how they could already be so turned off by the idea of women in politics. It's not lost on me as a young black woman that my first time voting for president comes 100 years after the adoption of the 19th Amendment, and that we're still arguing about women's competence as lawmakers. When people say women are too emotional to lead a country, are they saying an ideal president lacks empathy? When commentators attribute a woman's ability to lead to maternal instinct and a man's to earned leadership skills, are they saying that men's labor is real work and our labor is magic? My mother has tenaciously crawled out a living on the periphery, from cleaning lady to factory worker to McDonald's crew member. Isn't this the strength and work ethic we say we value? I'm proud to see my peers fighting sexism, registering to vote, protesting. We feel a responsibility to make this country reflect our values. While imagining a woman in the Oval Office still feels far-fetched, it won't if my vote helps a woman of color make VP. I know it's in my generation's hands to get us there. And next we have Paul Gardner, former felon. The last time I voted, it was 1992, and I was in fifth grade. Kids Voting USA was a big event where we all got to learn about the process. It had been touted since the beginning of the school year. But when the day of the mock election came, I was a little troubled by the way the Electoral College worked. I was thinking, wait, so we're not voting for president? We're voting for electors who were picked way before the primaries? That didn't sound right. By the next election, I had become a drug statistic. At 13, I started smoking marijuana and taking hallucinogens. At 15, I got into meth. I helped friends break into a car, and soon I had a record and a screw-the-system attitude. After cycling in and out of juvenile confinement, I spent 4 years in prison for theft. Back then, voting wasn't at the forefront of my mind. My focus was on basic necessities and survival, getting out of prison, finding somewhere to live, landing a job. But now at 39, nearly 3 decades after I cast my first ballot, I'm excited about being able to vote for the first time. Getting here wasn't easy. Those in power make it hard for many people with felonies on their record to get their rights back. There were lots of hoops to jump through. I had to file paperwork with the county clerk, and then it had to be approved by the judge and district attorney who originally saw my case. Some ex-felons have to pay fines or fees, others endure a 2-year waiting period. It's all a hassle, especially for someone recently out of prison. And I'm incredibly skeptical about how fair our elections even are. For most of my life, I've viewed the U.S. government as corrupt and stacked against the common man. But ultimately, getting back my vote felt necessary, because what if I'm wrong and our elections really are fair? If they are, I want my voice heard. Does having the right to vote feel like a privilege? Definitely. An acknowledgement that the work that I've done to better myself, getting sober, writing, earning a business degree, has paid off. Prison can be incredibly dehumanizing, and voting feels like another indicator that I'm an individual whose opinions matter. Every citizen's vote should count. This next article is called Bubba Wallace Calls Standing Up for What's Right the Thing He's Happiest He Ever Did. NASCAR's only black race car driver answers 20 questions for O, the Oprah magazine. There's a picture of Bubba standing with his arms crossed wearing his racing uniform. Bubba Wallace and I have been friends for almost 15 years. But in all the hours we've spent together, we have never deeply discussed the challenges he's faced as the only African-American driver in NASCAR's Cup Series. Then in February, Ahmaud Arbery was gunned down while jogging. The video of that incident sparked something in me, as it did for the nation and the world, and I called Bubba. In the conversation that followed, I learned so much about what he's experienced as an African-American man. As he says, it doesn't matter whether you're a race car driver or Joe Blow. You go through the same things. He told me that just a couple of years ago, police in an unmarked vehicle stopped him for crossing a double yellow line and asked how he could afford his car. Of course, he didn't say he could have bought all of their cars. As a white man, I have never had to bite my tongue like that. I gained a great deal of insight from talking to him then and in the days since. With the deaths of Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd, Bubba decided it was time to make his voice heard. His mother, who had competed in track and field from eighth grade through college, had raised him with stories about what it was like to be an African-American woman and athlete, hearing racial slurs from even coaches and faculty. She also raised him to love others and to respect everyone who showed him respect in return. She said she never imagined he would be an activist. I greatly admire the courage it took for him to step up and speak out, calling for Confederate flags to be banned. When I heard that garage pull-down rope in his stall had been tied into a noose, I was disgusted. I thought, how? I had never witnessed that kind of hatred in the NASCAR community. The next day at Talladega Super Speedway, there were 40 or 50 trucks outside parading the Confederate flag, and a plane overhead pulling a Confederate banner. I told Bubba I'd like to stand with him during the national anthem. When the other drivers heard about it, they wanted to join us, and then the crews wanted to be part of it too. That's how we all wound up in solidarity, marching down the pit road and pushing Bubba's car to the starting line together. When we got there, I turned around to see this incredible sea of people, all there to stand with him. Later, I was relieved when the FBI investigation determined that there was no evidence of a hate crime. Bubba tweeted, "To the next generation and little ones following my footsteps, love over hate every day." I hope that Bubba's bravery can lead all of us in racing to think about ways to make it more inclusive. The barriers to entry are higher than with many other sports. Cars are much more expensive than sticks and balls and gloves. We need to determine what systemic changes must happen to open more pathways for men and women of color. It's a big conversation, and we have Bubba to thank for sparking it, even though he'd never consider himself a trailblazer. He'd just say he was doing what needed to be done. And there is a powerful photo of Bubba standing in a t-shirt with the words, "I can't breathe, Black Lives Matter." And he's wearing a face mask, and the face mask has an American flag on it. And now we have 20 questions with Bubba Wallace. Number one, who is your hero? Lewis Hamilton, a 6-time Formula One world champion. He's also the only black driver in his series, and he's been vocal about racial injustice. Number two, what's the one thing in life you're so happy you did? He says, that I stood up for what's right. Number three, what makes you cry? I've cried at the track. When I finished second at my first Daytona 500 and at the Talladega Super Speedway when other drivers and crew pushed my car to the front of the starting grid, it meant so much to me to feel that love and support. Number four, what's the most important for your mental health? Music. I decided to learn to play the drums, which is the best medicine, for me at least. I mean, maybe not so much for those around me. Number five, who's the one person who changed your life? He says, well, there isn't just one. My parents, who shaped me, and my girlfriend Amanda, who's helped guide me. Number six, what the world needs now is for more people to embrace compassion, love, and understanding. Number seven, what gives you hope? Seeing that change is happening and that people are listening. There's much left to do, but I feel more hopeful than ever before. Number 8. What makes a good American? He says, treating everyone with respect. This country was founded on the premise that all men are created equal. Upholding that is part of the deal. Number 9. What makes you laugh? He says, family and friends. Number 10. What would you love to invent? A cognitive device that would let you complete all your daily tasks using only your thoughts. It'll be the new internet. Number 11. What makes a champion? Confidence, commitment, adversity, perseverance, positive energy, and a little luck. Number 12. Fill in the blank. Blank is all that matters. He says love. Number 13. What does home mean to you? It's a place for relaxation, decompression, and creating memories. 14. When do you feel most alive? He says, in a race car. There is nothing like being surrounded by all that power and speed. 15. What do you wish you could tell your childhood self? You can't make everyone happy, so don't try. 16. What would you love to learn? I want to keep educating myself on our country's history so that I can accurately expand my voice. 17. What historical event would you most like to have witnessed? Exploring the road to Hana and Maui, I learned about the 1946 tsunami. The waves approached at more than 500 miles per hour. I can't fathom that display of nature. 18. If you were creating a time capsule to be opened in 100 years, what would you put inside? One of my favorite watches. I hope it would still be ticking. 19. What's the greatest gift we can give each other? Respect. 20. What's the greatest gift we can give ourselves? Peace. Here we have an article called How My Life Changed After Being Diagnosed with a Rare Chronic Blood Cancer. I had two options, stay put or go out there and make a difference. Cinco de Mayo 2015 was a typical happy day for me. I was enjoying work and looking forward to celebrating the holiday until I suddenly felt very weak and had to leave work. For the past few months, I had been experiencing intense night sweats and very itchy skin. Since I was 50 years old, I assume my symptoms were due to premenopause. So this feeling of intense weakness took me by surprise. I managed to make it home from my office, and then my husband rushed me to the emergency room. I reached a point where I was unable to walk or talk. Breathing had become difficult, and even holding my phone was a challenge. I received blood transfusions and other IV treatments and was in the hospital for a week before I was able to leave on my own. That experience prompted me to find a hematology and oncology specialist to figure out what was really going on. Over the next year, I underwent numerous tests and various treatments as the doctors tried to understand what was happening to my body and how to fix it. Looking for answers. In November 2016, more than a year after I was hospitalized on Cinco de Mayo, my doctor recommended a bone marrow biopsy. My condition was not improving, and we were desperately looking for the root cause of my health issues. When the test came back, it showed that I had a mutation in the JAK2 gene and had developed high-risk primary myelofibrosis, otherwise known as MF, a rare chronic blood cancer. I had never heard of MF, and hearing the word cancer was terrifying, but at least I finally had an answer to what was wrong with me. Unfortunately, some patients wait years to learn they have MF as they struggle to cope with the life-changing symptoms, endless tests, and fear of not knowing what they have. Thankfully for me, my diagnosis came much sooner, and I was able to talk to my doctors about options for living with this condition. I learned that MF is part of a group of rare blood cancers called myeloproliferative neoplasms, or MPNs. They also explained that my cancer was causing scarring in the bone marrow, and disrupting my body's normal production of blood cells, causing me to experience the pain, itching, and night sweats that have plagued me for over a year. After my diagnosis, I made it a priority to learn as much as I could about MF so I could understand what was going on inside me. I had a wonderful team of doctors and a support system made up of friends and family that helped me come to terms with my condition and make a plan for managing the disease. I was prescribed a medication called Jakafi, a prescription medicine used to treat adults with certain types of MF. Jakafi works by keeping the production of blood cells under control and has helped to address many of my MF symptoms. I'm very fortunate that I found a treatment that works for me, but I can only speak from my experience, and I know that every patient with MF is unique. So my goal is to raise awareness of this disease and encourage other patients to go and see a doctor so they can discuss their concerns and find a management plan that's right for them. One way I've been able to take control of my condition is to become an advocate, not just for myself, but for the broader MF community. I share my story not only to raise awareness of my condition, but to inspire others with MF to talk to their doctors and to be advocates for themselves. I've also found purpose through supporting the broader cancer community. I bake rum cakes and sell them to fund a 5K race that helps women pay for mammograms, and I encourage healthy people to donate blood to help those in need. I am fortunate to have a dedicated team of doctors to manage my care, to have found the right treatment for me, and to be surrounded by a great support system to help keep me on my feet so I can be an advocate for others in need. I hope to help people understand my condition and how it has seriously impacted my life. I want people to know that even though I often look normal on the outside, something is not working on the inside. Through this awareness, I hope we can ensure more patients receive an accurate diagnosis and are empowered to go and speak to a doctor about their options. Life with MF is filled with unexpected challenges and setbacks, but I am a fighter. I try to remember that life is beautiful and that every day is a new day. When my MF journey started, I had two options: stay put or go out there and make a difference. I chose to make a difference. So even though I am living with cancer, I won't let anything stop me. All right, this next article is called Lenny Kravitz on Loving Lisa Bonet, Being a Gemini, and Writing a Book. In a new memoir, the pop rock icon opens up about the tapestry of forces that shaped him. Lenny Kravitz was exposed to a wealth of culture throughout his childhood, but it was the diverse influences of his mother, a black actor, father, a white Jewish journalist, and grandparents that produced a singular talent. Let Love Rule is part one of Kravitz's memoir, in which he chronicles his coming of age as an artist. From his home in the Bahamas, an Airstream, and an adjacent shack, the Grammy-winning musician and the first-time author spoke to O's Books editor, Lee Haber. You describe a distinct yin and yang within you, which makes total sense as you're a Gemini, a quintessential Gemini. I am deeply two-sided, you write. When did you become aware of the difference between your parents? I never thought about it until my first day of school, when a kid bolted out of nowhere, pointed at them, and yelled, "Your mother's black and your daddy's white." I'd never realized before that my parents didn't match. Yet somehow I knew that differences were blessings, that I had all these fabulous colors and characters and environments enriching me. Your parents lived on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. You lived across the street from Joe Namath. You partook of the glamorous life. My parents took me out with them whenever possible, so it's the early 70s, and we go to Cafe Carlyle to see Bobby Short, to the Apollo to see James Brown. I took painting and sculpture classes at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. At age 7, I saw the Jackson 5 at Madison Square Garden. You also spent a lot of time with your maternal grandparents in what was practically a different universe. Grandpa had a Sidney Poitier-style accent. Grandma spoke with a slight Georgia drawl. When I look back, I think of Mother's sister, Ruby Dee's character in Do the Right Thing, who watches over the neighborhood from her window. We had mother sisters everywhere. Life there was not only its own distinct universe. I was a whole other person there. And the interviewer says, in Manhattan, then in California, people like Sammy Davis Jr. and Taj Mahal were swirling around, but your first musical epiphany came when you were in junior high and heard Black Dog by Led Zeppelin. He says, we just moved to L.A. after my mother, Roxy Roker, got cast in The Jeffersons. Until then, I mostly listened to R&B, jazz, soul, and gospel, not so much rock and roll. At the time, I was hanging around all these surfer skateboarder kids in Santa Monica whose parents were hippies. They listened to Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix, Kiss, Cream, The Who. That's when I fell in love with electric guitar. The way it sounded, the way it looked, the attitude. It was while listening to Led Zeppelin that I smoked marijuana for the first time. It all hit me at once, how deep their music was. That moment changed my life. My ears, my mind, my soul were open. You write that the experience made your head explode. It opened a portal. After that, it was about me getting an electric guitar and learning how to emulate those sounds. But around that time, you also started singing with the California Boys Choir. My mother was worried I was being idle, so she set up the audition. And you found you liked it. Singing with them, I learned to use my voice properly, to sight read, and the sound moved me. I wouldn't be speaking to you today about a 30-year career in music had I not had that experience. You've always resisted being pigeonholed. Where did you find that early confidence to hold steady, even when the music industry feedback was, your music isn't black enough, or it's not white enough? Even as a teenager, I turned down record deals and people telling me they were going to make me a star, though I was frequently living on somebody's couch. I instinctively knew which doors were not to be walked through. My spirit wouldn't allow me. One of the couches you ended up on belonged to Lisa Bonet, about whom you write, "The poetry of her soul excited the poetry of my soul." And that's around the time when the music coalesced, right? When I met her, I was still calling myself Romeo Blue. I wasn't yet comfortable with Lenny Kravitz. I was still asking myself who I was and what I was trying to do. I saw myself in Lisa, and our whole love story opened up my life to the next plateau. It allowed the music to pour into me without even having to try. What did you want to express when you wrote the song Let Love Rule, which is also the title of your book? No matter what our differences, the final outcome between people must be love. It's easy to love you when everything is fabulous, when you're treating me the way I feel you should. It's when things go wrong, that's when we have to dig deep. Let Love Rule should be our anthem right now. Who wants to be in a world full of me's? I want the bouquet. All right, this next article is called As Former First Lady Michelle Obama's Assistant. Here is what I carried in my bag. When you're working alongside the nation's first black first lady, you have to be ready for anything. I've always been a little envious of women who show up with a little purse just large enough for keys and perhaps a cell phone. How do you slide through life with a bag that small? For as long as I can remember, I've carried a bag. Even as a young girl, I never left home without one. It equipped me with all the random tools I needed, but little did I know that one day it would come to represent much more. For my job, I carry an oversized black bag with me every day. In it, between purse dividers, I have Sharpies, a palm-sized battery-operated fan, sticky notes, floss, you name it. It's cute, yet durable, with ink markings and water spots telling its story through the years. Whenever it's opened, a floral scent from the fragrances of the lotions and oils inside permeates the air. All in all, with its straps, sturdy zippers, and contents, the bag weighs in at a whopping 5 pounds. You wouldn't carry a bag like this for just anyone, but I work for Michelle Obama. Whether you know her as a woman, a friend, a mother, author, style icon, hugger-in-chief, or the nation's first Black First Lady, she represents the epitome of what is possible with hard work, tough skin, and ambition. As an assistant, you're expected to be prepared for any and everything. But as an assistant to the First Lady, even now a former one, preparation means something totally different. You have to anticipate your boss's every move, playing out every imaginable scenario in your mind, and ensuring that nothing will distract her from the task at hand. You're the problem solver. You're the first line of defense, the one organized enough to think of others before yourself. It means having a ready-for-anything mindset and a bag. When I took over the position of trip director and special assistant to the First Lady in 2015, there were a few things that my predecessors noted that I should always have. Various types of ink pens, hand sanitizer, straws, tissue, and challenge coins, which are typically given to service members. But I took it to a whole new level, expanding from a list of 5 simple items to a plethora of supplies to anticipate the First Lady's unique what-ifs. I began carrying around what I then called my FLOTUS bag, a black low-and-sons purse with never-ending compartments. If you've ever watched Veep on HBO, you'll know a guy by the name of Gary Walsh, who was special assistant and personal aide to the vice president. Gary always carried a bag that seemingly weighed down his right or left shoulder. That bag sure looked heavy, and trust me, it is. That's what happens when the goal is perfection. While Mrs. Obama was the First Lady, I had to think of everything and consider every possible scenario. I knew her bag had to be different, because as the United States of America's first Black First Lady, part of my job was to help her deal with the nation's baggage around the notion of what she and her family were supposed to represent. So I filled it with 3 different kinds of lotion, a lighter one for her feet so that they wouldn't slip and slide in her heels, a thicker one for her body, and an ultra-thick one for those ankles, knees, and elbows, all in an attempt to prevent any possible ashiness. There would be no lack of moisture on my watch. I also carried hairspray for the flyaways and an edge brush just in case for smoothing down fine hair near the temples or around the hairline. Of course, there was also a pair of flats. She'd sometimes greet hundreds of people in photo lines and walk hallways the length of a football field or stand behind a podium for hours on end. Imagine the pain of walking in heels for extended periods of time, and then multiply that by 100. My bag also included straws because we all know the value of a good lip and a lint roller. I added bra clips and double stick tape to avoid any attire mishaps, and room temperature water because a sip right before hitting the stage will help eliminate a slight cough. There were mints because first impressions stick, and hand sanitizer long before it could not be kept on the shelves. I had dozens of it, so she could work a rope line, during which she freely engaged with supporters after a speech, hugging, taking selfies, holding babies, shaking hands, and talking to a crowd that spanned the length of a stage. I had chargers and extra sets of headphones because she always needed to be connected. I kept a nail file for those unexpected breaks and a sewing kit that came in handy during one White House correspondence dinner when a celebrity who shall remain nameless had a tear in her gown that I was able to fix with a safety pin from my FLOTUS bag. This bag has come to the rescue for many, not just our forever First Lady. To this day, even assisting Mrs. Obama post-White House, I'm still equipped with a first aid kit, stain removers, deodorant, a sponge to remove deodorant, oil blotting sheets, cough drops, and extra earring backs. Anytime my boss needs or asks for something that I don't have in my bag, I add it by our next trip. Mrs. Obama has lovingly teased me about my bag and why I feel the need to haul around so much stuff, but it's because I never wanted the story about her to be about the one hair that was out of place, or the one mark on her dress, or the one earring that fell, instead of the legacy the Obamas were creating. During their time in the administration, Everyone around them strived for perfection because there was no other option. There was too much on the line. We were in a unique situation. This was the first Black administration in the history of this country. It mattered so much to me, but it came naturally. I come from a rich matriarchy, a great-grandmother, grandmother, and mother, four generations strong, who made sure that the next would be better than the last. Growing up, my mom taught me that everything was in the details. She was a single parent who worked the graveyard shift for years to be available to me during the school day. That took planning. Mom always kept a small yellow legal pad on her nightstand near the phone and filled it with notes. I'd watch her work on our finances, brow furrowed as she calculated bills, every so often with a glimmer of worry in her eye. When she talked to our mechanic or our handyman, or even the teller at the bank, she took notes. To this day, I can see the piles of paper filled with the details that seemed so trivial at the time. Who she spoke to, the exact time, and everything that was discussed. So it was Mom who taught me to always be prepared, that you need a plan B through Z, because sometimes plan A doesn't always work out. She knew this world was not going to be fair, and in order to take it on, I would also have to learn how to be prepared, especially because being a Black woman in America means being born with two strikes constantly working against you, your Blackness and your sex. Both are things you have no control over, but you have to figure out how to navigate. There's the continuous struggle of yearning for identity and combating racism head on, realizing that as much as you try to conform, you can't fully, because your Blackness sets you apart. So you allow the lack of not being able to conform to shape your personal view of self, struggling with body image and needing to look a certain way, dealing with so many folks along the way that make you feel every bit of the fact that you don't belong, having your abilities doubted, talked down and written off at every other turn. On top of that, there are the undercutting microaggressions that you're forced to swallow with compliments, like, "You're so articulate," or, "Oh, you're so pretty for a Black girl," or, "Your hair, it's so fascinating." As a Black woman, you know all too well how the undertones of those compliments sting. You're constantly working overtime and twice as hard, never allowing yourself to be satisfied with anything less than the best, because it's what's required of you. And yet, this world causes you to doubt the essence of who you are every day. Not even the most perfect preparation can protect you from the horrors of racism. My mother taught me this lesson early on, and she made sure that I respected her as my mom and an elder, and that I valued her opinions, even though I used to fight her so much. But she understood exactly when to give me that little extra. "Well, I'm your mom, and this is the law," to get me to make better decisions for myself. And every time she did, it did work out for my own good. From having me attend a predominantly white elementary school so that I could get access to better resources and exposure to the green grass of the other side, to pushing me to attend an awards ceremony senior year of high school, even though my friends couldn't get tickets. That night, my mom was not having it. She put her foot down. Once again, she was right. I worked hard for this award and deserved it, and she knew if they were my true friends, they would want me to soar and not hold me back. Thanks to her insistence, I won one of the most prestigious awards of my young life on May 16, 2006, the Miami Herald Silver Knight Award. In hindsight, I owe so many of my greatest decisions to my mom. In fact, it was my mother who was the driving force behind my decision to accept the job as Mrs. Obama's trip advisor and special assistant. When I was offered the position in 2015, I had just hit my 2-year mark working for the Walt Disney Company's Government Relations Office in Washington, D.C. Given that it had taken 3 years to found a sound job with good pay, I was hesitant to give up that position, especially given that the Obamas only had 2 years left in their administration. But as always, my mom stepped in right on time, reassuring me that she was my safety net, and reminding me that I should refuse to let instability interfere with being able to dream. A decade later, I know exactly where that award is. In my closets, I have soccer trophies, honor roll certificates, pageant sashes, countless yearbooks and concert ticket stubs, and more lanyards than I can count. I hold on to these things because I want my future children to look back with pride at who I was and what I've done in my life. These little scraps add up to something bigger. They represent my legacy and the contributions to history that I've been blessed to be a part of thanks to two women, the mother who laid the foundation for the person I am today, and the boss and mentor who recognized that good foundation. To this day, I carry my bag with pride. It represents everything I've learned from my childhood and until now. It's all in that bag. My attention to detail, my knack for covering all of my bases, my ability to always prepare for life's what-ifs and see around corners and anticipate needs, read the atmosphere, be nimble and pivot on a dime, and acknowledge mistakes and learn quickly from them. When your bag is full of everything you need, both physically and spiritually, it's easier to handle the weight of the world. I learned that from my mom, in the White House, and through following Mrs. Obama into her new chapter. My journey is not unique. It's just one that I've been preparing for all of my life. Witnessing the day a black man would serve as the nation's commander-in-chief, then serving in that administration and supporting its forever first lady. But sometimes you just have to see something to know it's possible. And now, so many more generations will be born with that understanding too. All right, this next article is called Adopting During COVID-19. These families have been waiting years to adopt, but they didn't count on a pandemic getting in the way. Adopting a child is an emotional experience, even in the best of times. Factor in a global pandemic that has led to travel bans, court closings, and stay-at-home orders, and an intense time becomes uniquely stressful for couples hoping to expand their families. While babies don't stop being born just because there's a virus out there, and vulnerable children in the child welfare system don't stop needing the love of a new family, delays throughout the adoption process have meant that adoptive families and children alike have been left in limbo, and those who have been able to welcome children into their homes are struggling to navigate their new lives together in unprecedented circumstances. Just over 110,000 adoptions take place in the United States each year, according to the National Council for Adoption, a nonprofit based just outside Washington, D.C. That's around 9,000 per month, which means we'd be looking at almost 27,000 since the COVID-19 crisis prompted lawmakers across the country to announce lockdowns starting in March. In fact, while the actual number is unknown at this stage, it is certainly much lower than in previous years. This global pandemic will clearly reduce the number of adoptions, says Becky Fawcett, president of HelpUsAdopt.org, a national grant program that helps parents with the cost of adoptions. Between the travel ban and the personal financial crisis some families are experiencing, I can't begin to imagine the full impact this will have. 9 families took the time out from the hard work of parenting and quarantine to share their stories about the challenges and unexpected joys of adopting during COVID-19. From the heartbreak of not knowing when you'll be able to bring your little one home, to the joy of courtroom selfies and Skype celebrations commemorating a brand new family. For domestic adoptions, court closings and work stoppages are causing delays. Twyla, age 34, a physical therapist in Tennessee, and her husband Roger, 36, who works for a playground company, brought baby Nancy home from the hospital in September 2019. Some names have been withheld or changed at the request of interviewees. But they hadn't quite finished the formalities of adoption when COVID hit, and their agency was holding legal guardianship of Nancy until everything was lined up. "We have been wanting to finalize to make sure she's officially ours," said Twyla. The couple were finally ready, having raised the money to cover the remaining adoption fees, when she says, "Everything just started shutting down." When the COVID-19 crisis erupted, the process of finalizing Nancy's adoption was hit with delays as courthouses closed and non-essential workers were sent home. "Our family wasn't 100% legal yet, and with the added stress of what was going on with the virus, that was really scary," she says. To the couple's great relief, they were eventually given a court date, and Nancy was officially adopted on May 6th. With officials and family members in attendance via video conference, the occasion wasn't the in-person celebration that Twyla and Roger had hoped for, but they do have a unique souvenir, a courtroom selfie sent to them by a presiding judge. Twyla and Roger are among the lucky ones. For plenty of prospective adoptive parents, the pandemic has meant pressing pause on the domestic adoption process, with no way of knowing when they might be able to bring their children home. Robin, age 58, a professional organizer in Los Angeles, is coming to terms with an indefinite delay to her adoption proceedings. All of my paperwork was completed, and I was ready for my in-home visit by the county, and then COVID hit, she says. A single mom to a 15-year-old daughter, Robin is hoping to adopt another 15-year-old girl she met through the charity KidSave, which connects children aged 9 through 18 with families wishing to mentor, host, or adopt. At this time, the county is not doing any in-person visits or virtual visits, so I just wait, she says. It's disappointing. It seems very unfortunate that they're not moving forward and getting kids into permanent homes if that's what they want. Life doesn't stop just because we're staying at home. International travel bans are keeping children from their families with potentially heartbreaking results. While court closures have stalled domestic adoptions and a rash of job losses may mean that some families can no longer adopt, closed borders and travel restrictions are complicating international adoptions. Sarah Jo Floyd and her husband Michael, both 35, live in rural Kansas with their daughters Camden, 7, and Avonlea, 5. The couple, an artist and warehouse worker respectively, were due to travel to India this spring to collect 16-month-old Elliot from an orphanage in a major city there. Given the international travel ban and the fact that India is currently in full lockdown, those plans have had to be postponed. I was devastated. It just feels very uncertain, says Sarah Jo, who is particularly worried about Elliot because the toddler faces several health challenges, including the fact that she is blind. The Floyd's concern for their adoptive daughter, with whom the family was matched in January, is more than justified, according to Becky Fawcett of HelpUsAdopt.org. Parents not being able to travel to reach their adoptive children abroad is a major issue, she points out. Some of the kids who are medically fragile will most likely not survive, and some will age out of the system before their families can get to them. Even couples whose international adoptions are well underway face complications. Gina and her husband Mark, both 36 from Illinois, have just been given a court date to finalize the adoption of a 2-year-old girl in Bulgaria. After the court date, we should receive an official decree a couple of weeks later, at which point we can hypothetically book travel to go pick her up and bring her home, says Gina. Whether or not that can happen is still very much up in the air, however. We're waiting for the EU to open completely and for the U.S. Department of State to lower its threat level for international travel, she explains. There are still a lot of questions, like whether we'll have to quarantine when we arrive in Bulgaria and what that will even look like. What other restrictions will be in place? What if we get sick while we're traveling? Will there be any other delays processing immigration? Given the unknowns, all prospective parents can do is wait and hope. Sarah Jo is looking to daughters Camden and Avonlea for inspiration in terms of staying positive. She says, just seeing their faith and how calm they are about this has really helped me. There are some virtual solutions, and while some are positive, others are not. The unexpected roadblocks facing adoptions have led to workarounds and even a few bright spots. In the normal course of things during their domestic adoption, New York-based Eric Emke, 34, a graphic designer and art director for Disney on Broadway, and Alan Lane, 34, a fundraiser for the Metropolitan Opera, would have had just one in-person meeting with their baby's birth mother. Instead, says Lane, doing it all digitally meant we were able to meet with her 3 different times and really develop our relationship to the point where I actually think we're much closer now. That was an unexpected plus to quarantine precautions, but there were definitely downsides to adopting in the midst of a pandemic. On May 8th, the couple took custody of 2-day-old Margot directly from her birth mother outside the hospital, with social distancing measures in full force. To have to add those very impersonal barriers, both the distance and the mask, it made it really challenging to balance the moment, says Lane. It's a celebration for us, and it's a loss for the birth mother. So to add the element that we can't console her or hug her to show our gratitude and support was a real challenge. The good news for the families? Extra time together. For the couples whose adoptions have gone ahead, despite the challenging circumstances, bringing their child home has meant sheltering in place as a new family. Novelist James, age 45, and his air traffic controller husband, Garen, 34, brought two-year-old Emmanuel home from South Africa in March, just one day before the cancellation of all flights from South Africa to the U.S. With numbers of the COVID-19 cases in South Africa very low at that stage, the couple were shielded from the stress of the pandemic until they got home to Florida. "We had no idea how close we were to the edge," says Wade. Staying home nonstop in the 2 months since then has been tough on their older child, now 7, who was looking forward to getting back to normal after 6 weeks in South Africa. But the couple feels quarantine has actually been helpful in terms of settling Emmanuel into his life in the U.S. The orphanage that he was in was akin to a single-family home, and he had spent his whole life there, explains Siriano. And now he spends all of his time in our home. Kelly, age 38, and Sanjay, age 41, who have been isolating in Georgia with a 4-week-old Issa since picking him up from the hospital parking lot in April, have also appreciated the enforced family time. It gave the couple time to bond. They said it prepared us for parenthood a little bit, and that it was just our little family together all the time. But, Alexandra says, the silver lining is that we've all had more time to connect with Jem, talk with him one-on-one. Playing games has been a really great way to be talking, but not have it be such a pressure-filled conversation. Still, there are losses. One source of regret for Jem and his new family is that, due to COVID-19, they've had to cancel a trip planned to coincide with the finalization of his adoption in Ohio. Jem is really excited that the court date will take place over Skype, allowing the family to seal the books and move forward, says his new mom. Despite the delays and disappointments, many families are finding ways to work through the complicated logistics. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ann Jordan, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.